You are listening to Tempest in a Stockpot. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barris.
And together we're agitating for change in Northern BC. We're calling this episode Mapping Food Justice, where we discuss how wide is the gap between availability of fresh food and actual access to it for local people. In the first half of this episode, we'll consider access to BC salmon. Most Northerners take salmon for granted, but there are children in Prince Rupert, the majority of them Indigenous, who can't get local salmon as part of the school lunch program. Two people on Tsimshian territory are attempting to bridge that gap. Diane Vilsesh, the Community Food Systems Program Manager with EcoTrust Canada, and Elena Pite, the Project Developer with the T-Buck Suzuki Environmental Foundation. Then, our focus will turn to the BC Association of Farmers Markets Coupons Program, which is a BC-wide project that offsets some of the painful prices in order to provide access to local, nutritious food at farmers markets, thanks to another bridge builder, Peter LeBlanc. While you're checking your stockpot, consider where do you hold shame, and what do you celebrate? Are these items local, or do they travel a long distance to reach your kitchen? Which foods do you consider a sign of luxury? And which items do you take for granted? Okay, let's see what's cooking, good looking. British Columbia is recognized around the world for our wild Pacific salmon, of which there are five main species: Chinook, Coho, Sockeye, Pink, and Chum. Salmon are unique in that they're born in freshwater, they migrate to the ocean to mature, and then they swim back to their birthplace to spawn. To accomplish this feat, salmon follow hundreds of watersheds across BC. Salmon are considered a sacred food and an integral part of the culture, spirituality, and identity of many First Nations across BC. For thousands of years, salmon have been a primary source of physical and spiritual sustenance and are deeply entwined with the cultural fabric of Indigenous communities in the Pacific Northwest.
My name is Elena Pite. I'm the project developer with the T-Buck Suzuki Environmental Foundation.
My name is Diane Vilsesh. I'm the Community Food Systems Program Manager with EcoTrust Canada. I live in Prince Rupert, BC, which is located on unceded Tsimshian territory. Prince Rupert is located on an island, so we're surrounded by ocean. So the challenges that we have in Prince Rupert is that we literally have zero access to the foreshore, which is one issue. CN owns the entire foreshore area and the port and Dubai World, so it's owned by global corporate entities and corporations. And the main issue is that 90% of all fish that's harvested in British Columbia waters end up being sent to foreign countries, either for processing or they're just sold because the owners of the licenses are or can be foreign corporations or foreign entities or other multinational corporations. So it just in the last few years, the last plant in Prince Rupert shut down, Canfisco. And so at one time, some fish were landed and processed in Prince Rupert, but that's the last of it. It will never happen again. So all the fish that's harvested goes to China, is canned in China, and then shipped back to BC. So in addition to this issue, Prince Rupert is the third largest, deepest natural port in the world, and we have huge port expansion going on. It takes 3 days less to get to China from Prince Rupert than it does from Vancouver, so it makes Prince Rupert a very important port in that sense. However, there's also a level of pollution in nearby waters. So not only is it impossible to fish in our local waters, almost impossible. You can fish if you go a little further and if you're okay with the pollution level in the harbor. The challenge is that we just don't have any access. And so for most people, it's just unaffordable to take a boat and go fishing because you have to go a little bit further to get that healthy fish. And as I said before, most of the fish that's harvested in BC waters is shipped off to other places. And we import that back, so which is the craziest thing. Another issue is that licenses are allowed to be bought up by foreign entities. And so we're basically allowing Canadian fish to go to other countries. And it seems crazy to me that we would do that because when we're talking about food security, it's so important that we have access to our Canadian fish and we don't.
Yeah, it's challenging, like this romantic version that I have of Prince Rupert. To go down there and I'll just walk up to a boat and be able to purchase that
Okay, most of the time that can't happen because you have to have a vendor's license. Like the fisherman, the owner, it's actually the license holder has to, and the owner has to have a vendor's license. And it's a provincially regulated vendor's license. And oftentimes the owner doesn't even reside in Canada and will not sign that. And the fish are already spoken for.
So it's a different license to be able to go fish.
Yes.
Then be able to sell it to someone. And you got to sell it to someone who's got the vendor's license.
Yep. Exactly. And all of this started multiple decades ago when fishing licenses became privatized. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a mom and a pop going out harvesting. It was then becoming the processing plants or multinational corporations that then own that license and that quota to harvest that fish. And they're able, because it's private, they can lease it out or sell it on the open market. They lease it and then they get to dictate where that fish goes. And so the harvester, the boots on the deck, the skipper that is driving the boat, that's manning the gear, that's running the line, they're not actually reaping the benefits. And then subsequently, the community isn't reaping the benefits of the fish that is caught in the waters. And you really see that in Prince Rupert, where the infrastructure has suffered. You can't get ice. Harvesters who are out of town, there's no showers that they can access. Those aspects of the fishery and that community and that industry have just gone by the wayside because the value of the fish isn't being brought into community.
On the East Coast 30 years ago, we walked up to a lobsterman and bought fish off the, can we not still do that in PEI? Has that all changed?
It's bonkers because on the East Coast, there's a policy and it's called owner-operator. And so if you own the license to harvest that lobster, or harvest that fish in Atlantic waters, you have to be operating the vessel. So you, when that vessel is fishing, so they get to decide where that fish goes and where it's landed. They can sell it down at the docks, and it's that framework exists in the East Coast. It's called owner-operator. Right now on the West Coast, we never got that. It went privatized. So now there's a movement to bring that back. Obviously, it's not going to be a one size fits all, and it's maybe not necessarily owner operator, but this fisheries modernization to bring that benefit that fish and the fishing industry has back into community and bringing that supply, bringing that salmon into schools or into community and being able to purchase it directly from the harvester.
That doesn't make any sense to me. I've lived here 10 years and I've never bought canned salmon because people keep gifting it to me. And you're telling me that we can't get it onto lunch plates for Indigenous children.
That is our challenge. So we need to buy it from a fish processor. So that's the first hurdle. And then we're paying a huge cost. So if the harvesters can sell for $2 a pound, the fish processor will sell it back to us for $22 a pound. In the same day, which is just not affordable. It would be really lovely if we could actually buy directly off the vendor or the harvester, but that fish is all spoken for. It's going somewhere else. And when you talk about farmland, the ocean is kind of our farmland and we don't have any access to it. And that's the craziest part. What people don't realize too, like in Prince Rupert, for example, 64% of our students in the school system are Indigenous. So not only is this culturally relevant food, it's also brain food. We want our students to have the best possible outcomes. And it starts with feeding them healthy food.
As a personal trainer, I know that fat is really important for a healthy brain.
Yeah.
So it's the perfect food.
It is.
It's great, yeah.
But if we really value our youth and think spending 6 to 7 hours a day is important education-wise, it should just be part of it.
Yeah.
And it's not a band-aid to be saying we're going to have hot meals for our future leaders.
Yeah.
But we're going to provide it as part of that system that we seem to think is so important that they spend all this time in.
Well, just touching on what you said, you know, this child poverty stats in British Columbia for Prince Rupert are higher than anywhere else in British Columbia. So over 24% of Prince Rupert children live in poverty and they don't have food to bring to school, to lunch, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the school district itself is about 1,850 students. And there's right now this year, or last week, I heard the numbers were 464 students are in the school food program. Mm. And that's nearly 25%, which matches the child poverty rates in Prince Rupert. Yeah. So there's a huge need for food security immediately.
And it's even just using the capitalist idea of economies of scale. If as a community, we contribute together, you can mass purchase and probably make those better meals that are even coming from a middle-class family that can't afford. If we work together as a community, we pave our roads collectively. We could feed our kids collectively better.
Right.
By acknowledging that that's what we actually want to do. Mm-hmm. And then let's change the rules so we can do it locally.
And change the attitudes so that people who are already preparing foods for their children want to get their children enrolled in this program because it's so healthy.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what is your project then? With all this despair, what are you doing about it?
I personally try and tell people as much as I can, educate people, and make them aware of what's going on and what the reality actually is. And it's amazing. Most people don't realize.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's the biggest hurdle. I think when people understand the conditions and the lack of access to our veg, that's when you'll start hopefully seeing change.
Yeah, I feel like there's a bit of a misconception in like academia and just in the general public that, oh, I don't have access to fish because it's been overfished and there's no more fish left. And there's kind of this dramatic response to it. But that's not actually the case. We have lots of thriving fisheries and it's all very sustainably managed for how much you can take. But the problem is that fish that's being caught in those thriving fisheries isn't filtering into communities. It's going elsewhere.
Right. So there's immediate response, like the project that's fundraising, to be able to pay probably the inflated prices.
Absolutely.
Because they have to be able to access the salmon into the schools.
So we actually priced out what it would cost last year. We calculated that there were 430 students in the school lunch program, and the goal was to feed those students 100-gram servings per month for 10 months of the year. And for us to purchase that fish from a plant would essentially cost us almost $20,000. We can't do that. It's too expensive.
Well, most school food programs, isn't it about $3 to $5 a meal is their whole budget?
So we really would like to be able to purchase off the vendor, you know, maybe make it a few dollars more per pound. It would make it more affordable, right? Instead of $20,000, maybe it would cost us $5,000 a year, which would then make it more affordable and doable, right?
Yeah.
And so we are having a fundraiser in March. I think it's March 2nd. And our goal is to not only raise awareness, but raise enough funds that we could at least purchase enough salmon so that each child could at least have one serving of salmon per month.
So if we value owner-operator and our local people coming first, and then maybe bigger global systems, we can design systems because they're already there. But it's sometimes a choice that maybe has been made in the past, but then how do we advocate for that? Or, I'm not right in Rupert. I am more landlocked, but I care about this. How do we support that action?
So there's a phenomenal grassroots movement. It's called Fisheries for Communities, and it's a joint effort between TBUC Suzuki and EcoTrust Canada and many local harvesters and community members. And what it is really advocating and lobbying for that policy and that license change, because that's where it needs to come down to, is that top down for the license and the big structural change. On the small side of things, we work creating a market that supports the small scale harvesters that have fought through the privatization of fisheries and have held on to their licenses and have gone through the work of getting a vendor's license, and being able to support them and purchase from them and provide them a market is huge as well.
But I am curious, like you go to Rupert, there is like the Dollies or the Rupert
Meats.
Are those some of the kind of businesses that you talk about? So they're there, but we have to look for them, and maybe it's not exactly walking down to the dock and buying there.
Yes,
but there are some. Yeah, so we can be, even if it's me as a consumer, rather than just going to those whatever normal grocery store and looking, might have to do a bit of work.
Yeah.
If I want to vote with my dollar, I still can.
You won't necessarily find local seafood in the grocery store, but, you've mentioned Dolly's and Rupert Meats, and there's also Fukasaku. Dai Fukasaku is a huge advocate for purchasing local seafood and does his best to procure what he sells from local vendors. So there are a few. And the other challenge is, and as Alina mentioned, supporting those people who can get the vendor's license and who can sell. after fishing for the opening, however long it is, and coming back to the dock, it's a lot easier to just offload at the plant than it is to start doing dock sales. So having some sort of infrastructure in place to allow for that to happen, like a fishmonger, perhaps, or something like that, would be hugely beneficial.
So how do people get involved? Who do I contact?
Well, we've been slowly organizing and getting things in place. We have the salmon, I believe, is it purchased or it's on?
It's been purchased through Arrow Trading, and they're holding it because we don't have a facility at the moment to hold or process the fish. But it's been earmarked for the fundraiser and also for the school district minerals program.
And so as we get closer to the date, which is, I think, March 2nd, we will be advertising. There'll be notices up on social media and posters around town, and we'll do our best to get the word out there. And we'll certainly be contacting local media as well to help get that word out. But, we're hoping for a huge turnout, and it's all about raising funds. We'd like to make this an annual event, so keep the momentum going. And we were so fortunate to receive some funding from PHABC Ideas Lab. And so some of that we can use to purchase salmon. And then the rest of it was for the fundraiser. So our goal is to raise enough money. In the ideal world, we'd like to raise $25,000, because that would not only help fund the salmon for the coming year, but also $5,000 for the next fundraiser as well.
It can happen every year, and that the fundraiser can raise funds for the purchase of the salmon, because you want to buy it in season, which the salmon season is July, August. So we want to be able to purchase it ahead of that time and then
process it.
Yeah.
And what kind of salmon are you hoping to?
Sockeye July, August is that season. But there's spring or Chinook salmon trolling in Area F north of Haida Gwaii. That season's end of August to September. There's some great harvesters that participate in that fishery. So if we can, it'd be fantastic if we can get a variety of different types of salmon.
And if someone's not in Prince Rupert to see it happening locally, through Eco Trust,
yes, absolutely,
Canada and the T-Bucks Suzuki Environmental
and Foundation. Even through the school district, and the city of Prince Rupert has also started up a page for our project.
City of Rupert's website.
Yep, around food security initiatives that we're all working on together.
Great. And for the bigger pie in the sky licensing issues with fisheries, the Fisheries for Communities, they have an Instagram, their own website. It's got plenty of resources there and some calls to action if you want to raise your voice through that.
You are listening to Tempest in a Stockpot. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barrett.
Before the break, Diane Villaches and Elena Pike shared their ideas for ensuring that school children in Prince Rupert are guaranteed occasional lunch meals that include local salmon. Now we want to turn to Peter LeBlanc, program manager with the Farmers Market Nutrition Coupon Program. Peter realized that lower-income families couldn't afford to shop at farmers markets, so he created a coupons program that made sure they could. Are there problems with this program? You bet there are, but it's one excellent tool we should be encouraging. And as my grandmother often reminded me, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Maybe you can start with just giving us a brief history of the program.
So we started this program in 2012, and it came up just a casual conversation between the executive director of BC Farmers Markets at that time and someone in government, and they had a conversation and said, hey, have you ever considered doing a program that would support low-income British Columbians and connected to farmers markets? They have programs like that in the States. And then all the pieces fell together, and they offered suddenly the organization. They said, we've got some funds for you. Can you write a grant to spend the funds? And they're like, okay, great. And so came up with this plan to launch the Farmers Market Nutrition Coupon Program. And back then when it started, it was $15 a week, and you had specific eligible items that you could buy: fruit and veg, meat, nuts, cheese, herbs. It was limited to those things, and then working with some specific populations. And we were in about 12 different communities that first year. And then the next year we got some expanded funding, and then it's just continually ramped up from, I think, about $500,000 the first year to now we're managing a program that's about $4.25 million, and it's brought us from like 15 partners up to 250 partners, and I said 12 communities, now up to 100 communities. We've had some jumps in the value per week because the $15 in 2012 isn't as much now, so it's gone to $21, then it went to $27. Eventually, they added another category of food plants. They added honey in, and so had those various evolutions. But we've always been able to work in communities where there's a existing farmers market that has the eligible items at it, plus community partners who are working with the target populations. And between those two, we had this great partnership where low-income British Columbians could access food at farmers markets, and that was the way they were getting supported to eat healthy and support their food security needs.
Peter, something I'd really like to know, what would you consider the three core values that underpin the program, and how do they shape it or make it unique in some way?
Yeah, so I think the first one is that we design a program that is dignified for people to participate in it. So if they are having trouble making ends meet, buying food, we want to make the experience of shopping at the market feel like shopping at a market as if you had your own money and that was what you wanted to do. So we design the coupons, we prepare the markets to be welcoming, we have the partners there to support participants who might have some hesitation on how to use the coupons or what people will think of me using it. And so by the time you're in the journey of experiencing the market, you're coming in there and buying food from farmers. You're getting farmers who are super grateful that you're buying food from them because they're there as a business, yes, but they're also in the business of farming because they care about what people eat. And so being able to support the community members who are struggling to get healthy food and actually see them getting their food, That makes them feel good about their experience. And also, this is unique in a lot of the food programs that can occur, is that we are focusing that 100% of the food is from local producers. So if you're shopping at BC farmers markets, it's guaranteed that the farmer made it, baked it, grew it. That's where it came from. And that is something that takes the same money that is being provided to people to shop. They are now providing that to our local farmers to reward them and make their business more viable. So I think that's another key tenet, is that the fact that the same funding is used twice, once by someone who's accessing food and a second time by someone who is able to then use that to support their own families. And the other thing that I think is really important, and we see it quite a lot, is that it starts to stitch communities together in a different way that says that you are having trouble accessing food and your resources are limited. You get to come to the farmer's market. The farmer's market looks more like the community, and it just makes the market experience an improvement over everyone. So I think those are the three core pieces that I see.
You mentioned some of the statistics already,
yeah.
But how many people are fed with the program each year and how much money is directly invested back into the farming economy? You said 4.25 is what the program is.
Yeah.
How much of that is actually like writing coupons that would be, I could say, going back into farmers?
Yeah, because of course to operate the coupon, we're printing the coupons.
Yeah, there's always...
We have some other pieces that are costs associated with it, but when it comes to how many dollars are back into farmers' pockets, simply from the coupons is $3.5 million was what it was last year, roughly. That does not include the fact that folks who have coupons are also spending their own money. And for every dollar they spend in coupons, they're usually bringing another 50 cents of their own money in. So that means 3.5 plus almost another 1.75 million is coming into the market, into the farmers' pockets. I believe there are 12,000 unique households that are receiving coupons over the course of the year, mm-hmm. province-wide. And then there's an average of 2.5 members in each household. So close to 25 or 30,000 British Columbians are eating food based on receiving the coupons.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I know just in our community, right? It's $44,000 that of the coupons, right? Like that's any of them in there. And like for such a small area, like that's,
it
would be, it would have such a negative impact, I think, on our farmers market if we didn't have that coupon program. I know there's vendors who rely on it, makes it worthwhile for them to put the effort in to grow and show up.
And there's some studies underway right now from the University of Northern, UNBC, University of Northern British Columbia. And they're looking at the impact of the coupon program on farmers and seeing what difference it makes for them to both be at the market, the how much of a percentage of the income comes from coupons. So we'll be interested to see those statistics because it is unique across Canada for this program to be operating. But it spawned a couple of programs in other other parts of the country. So it's in Nova Scotia, Manitoba, and in Quebec, where there's funding coming in from their provinces to support and develop coupon programs. And they're on an upward trajectory as well, like ours, our journey from 2012 to now.
That's really exciting. I'm almost in tears here as I'm thinking about the waves of impact that this thing is having on people. Yeah. Who do you think isn't being served by this program but could be?
The demand for the program exceeds our capacity quite a bit. We've accumulated a waiting list of over 1,000 people who reached out to us just to be on the program and let us know when it launches. So we share that out with our partners. But by the time they've got their spots, most of them are already full. We had 50 partners in other parts of the province where we have the program existing. They asked to join the program, but we were at capacity. So we know that they're all sitting on a group of folks who could benefit from it. And then this does focus on three specific target populations, the seniors and elders, the pregnant persons, and then families with children. But there are also people who are struggling who are just single adults. And so we know that there's some missing segments of the population that we just can't reach. And so we always advocate for both more funding and or hopefully free up resources by providing this to organizations that work with those populations to just have a little bit extra from their own resources to support those folks too.
You talked about two changes that you want to make in order to include more people, but I would like to encourage also thinking outside the box, a little less bureaucratically, because that's where we often get into trouble. We put limits on who can have the food. And if we could think a little less bureaucratically about that, that might help too.
And I get that. And we know that in other provinces, the folks who can participate may only be, you know, they just have to be lower income and in need. And that works in that section. We're under the Ministry of Health, and we appreciate the fact that they have said, we can't reach everybody. And in our estimation, priority populations are the seniors, families with children, and pregnant persons, because they're definitely in need. But they say that, but they don't say that the other populations aren't in need. They're just saying, like, if we only have so much money, we want to focus it on those that are the ones we want to have the best outcomes for to start with. So we're ready. We're ready to scale it up and open it and broaden it up as soon as we have some extra support. And ideally, run it year-round, you know, because there's a lot of produce province-wide that could be provided year-round. It'll be seasonal. It'll depend on the community. What's available in the north will be a little bit different than what's on the island versus Haida Gwaii, etc. But still, we think there's capacity for folks to be able to access the program year-round.
Well, and senior elders are a recent addition, isn't it? Only in the last 3 years? This is the third
since day one. They've been involved.
Okay, my apologies.
Yeah, we've had, though, they have had some upgrades. Like we had in 2012, they invested an additional $1 million. So they took us from 2 to 3 and then from 3 to 4 million in 1 year in order to add in some extra funding for seniors.
Oh, okay.
Because they were seeing them at that point as being particularly vulnerable. And certainly the economy hasn't changed much to their benefit over the last 3 or 4 years.
But I mean, I have faced as a community partner people saying, like, if it's all about choice of what people get to eat, why do they have to use it at the farmer's market? Is there some other policies or other barriers for people? Because not everybody can get to a market. Right?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. Now, we know then what that means is as partners will say, someone will say to them, I can't get to the market. It doesn't have the types of things I would enjoy. Then they probably don't enroll them. If we found that partners were saying we can't actually find enough people to use these coupons, then we'd have to look at how do we make changes to it. But since all of our partners fill all the spots with people who can get to the market, and then last year, 98% of the funds that the Ministry of Health put into the part of the budget for coupons was redeemed.
98%.
So we don't have a big gap in finding folks who can use it, even though we do know that it's not going to be a fit for everyone. But then we feel like the magic of the program is that it is building capacity at the farmers market to be a stronger market, and it's providing folks with guaranteed locally produced food. It's keeping the money in the community. And so we think that if we saw the numbers change, that people just couldn't get to the market, then we would look at making those changes. But since it does work really well, and we're through the BC Association of Farmers Markets, we want to support, promote, and farmers markets, we're very happy to do our best to make it a successful program that exists exclusively at farmers markets. And
you also enable some of that too, though, because you're offering money for people to get transported to the market. I think that's far reaching.
Yeah, we do invest in grants for reducing barriers for transportation, and so that does help out quite a lot. But we also see that markets and partners end up bending their communities to improve the market themselves. So bus stops have been installed in certain places because the market is there. They've added accessibility parking around markets, and they've been able to just go in and get the municipality to do that. In Cranbrook, they were offering the bus free of charge on Sundays because they were already running the buses. They didn't have high rate ridership. And so why not operate it on the same day the market is operating and just get people to and from the market? So you wouldn't have to pay a fare if you were heading to the market.
Peter, what's your hope for the program?
The dream would be, well, years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I was talking with our colleagues at the Ministry of Health, and we both said, do we dare dream that this would reach every community in the province that wanted it? And we were at half the markets and communities in BC. And then within 2 or 3 years, we reached that goal by just saying it out loud. We were able to make the pitch that we have more communities that are at capacity to accept this program, and they have partners who are willing to do it. And now if there's a new community or new partner, we always find a way to bring them in. What I'd like to see is for us to be able to operate this program year round. Right now we operate it for 16 weeks, 4 months. So that's, we're a third of the way there. So we go from 4 million to 12 million, then we can operate it year round. If we went to 24 million, we could double the amount of folks who are in the program. So we do ask the province to consider that. That's a big ask. So we're also working with our colleagues across Canada to try and get the federal government to come in on this in this whole endeavor and match and double the programs that are being offered provincially. And I think that would start to get us towards those goals of year-round and reducing the waiting lists.
Out of curiosity under that, because you're talking about how much comes from the ministry and from the provincial government, but you also do have some private philanthropy or other means of funding that goes into this program. I mean, some of those sources you probably can't go through. It probably doesn't matter as much, but I just was curious about the amount of funding that's, do you have that in terms of also, I know locally some of us fundraise. Expand the program that way. It doesn't always have to come direct government funding.
So thinking about how much funds were coming in that were not from the Ministry of Health, there was probably another $500,000 last year that came in from other funders. So, for example, in the Columbia Basin region, in the Kootenays there, the Columbia Basin Trust said, whatever the province does, if there's some gaps, we'll cover up some of those gaps. So they're investing $225,000 a year, and they just renewed with a 3-year commitment to continue doing that. So we appreciate that. And then we have some businesses that have said that they would like to support and expand in the communities they operate in. So that's certainly the case up here in this region with Newmont Mines investing another $25,000 to be in the program. A couple weeks ago, I was at West Coast Seeds and they had a seedling sale. And from that sale, they donated $12,500 to the coupon program in Vancouver. That program in Vancouver raises about $70,000 or $80,000 a year to bring in 4 partners with 50 more spots each. And so there's all these opportunities that come up. It can be as little as an MLA saying, I'm going to sponsor one family for $432 to more of the larger donations that will support multifamilies. So we try to get out of the way of doing that by not saying no, that you can't do that. And the ministry has been good about saying if someone wants to level up the program and use the existing infrastructure, they're supportive of that too. So we appreciate that. We get that flexibility so we can support partners in getting more funding. Yeah.
Well, I think that's that, and it's an interesting piece, like you said, like the ripple effects, and, mm-hmm. and yeah. that in that it provides a framework then for organizations to already support. So like, not to brag a little bit, but the last 2 years we've raised over $10,000 locally in the Hazeltons.
Incredible. Such a small...
Because food security, food sovereignty is such a majority of our population.
Yeah.
And it's the framework's already there, right? Yes, so it's partners that are like, we already wanted to do something. We've got this money sitting here, but all the administration and bureaucracy would take to start a program, we're already got it going. And their people are already using it. And so we can just amplify it, right? So I think that has been really exciting to be able to, oh, this is already in place. Let's just amplify it.
Yeah.
And they love it because their money stays locally. They know the faces that it's supporting. It's not going into a larger that then is hoping to come back and affect us.
Or even invest in something brand new that has no track record.
Exactly.
You can tell them what has happened here over the last several years and saying, you'll just be allowing us to do more. Way to use the tools.
Yeah, we're not starting from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And that inspires other people in the community to also get involved. Mm.
Yeah, so some of the things that have evolved, which I think are some of the most magical things that have happened. So we used to have, as when this first started, is that you as a participant get coupons, but the partner, they expect you to provide folks with some skill building courses, and you want 6 hands-on courses. And we felt like the partners were feeling incredible pressure to make sure everybody attended and that they did it wrong if they didn't. And then we stepped back and talking to the Ministry of Health, and we learned that some of our partners would say, the person who's leading the skill building class is someone who's participating. They were a chef. They're no longer in a good position right now, but they definitely can tell you how to prepare and cook some delicious food, especially on a budget. So then we just started to encourage our partners to say, you might have skill and depth on the bench of people who are in the program to offer to your colleagues these opportunities. And I see it even, I've even seen it up in Hazelton whereby I come by and visit the market, and at the table there might be someone there whose job it is to greet people, hand them their coupons, and those folks are able to shop. There's also some sampling going on at the table. But usually that person is also someone who has or is receiving coupons themselves. So they're taking an upgraded journey into this program, and they're now helping deliver it. And how welcoming is it for someone to be talking to someone who also uses a program? So those are a couple of really neat things I've seen. There have been a couple of instances where a community partner is operating and there's a farmer's market, and the farmer's market team is burnt out. And then, for example, and they just decided to pack it in Houston 1 year. And following that, Houston Link to Learning, who was there every week and had a booth there and was supporting people through their programs to enjoy the coupons, they said, we're going to take over running the market and the coupon program. Same thing happened in Clearwater. The farmers decided to pack it in, and the Clearwater Yellowhead Community Services started operating the market. And many times we'll go back and meet with partners, and the person who's now running the program was someone who had previously received the coupons. And it's just so great to see that that journey that you can, you just, you're in the program, but you might take different roles in it. Mm-hmm. So,
and I think seeing people in those different roles, that's what also reduces that stigma.
Yes.
Right around the have and the have not and the being ashamed to use it versus being what a great community building tool this coupon program is.
Yeah.
And we see it here. People are like encouraging. This is such a great program. You go sign up for it. Don't be ashamed.
But also look at the puzzle pieces that you're putting together.
Yeah.
You originally just wanted to feed people because they were low income. And now they're running part of the program.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 There were some vendors in Vancouver and they were a meat vendor. And they had some newcomers who came with coupons and said, do you ask if they had anything halal? And the vendor was like, I'm not even really sure what that is. And so they explained it and they said, I wouldn't even know where to begin. Well, I says, well, we know how to do it. So then they ended up becoming part of that vendor's team
nice.
To be able to make sure that this was something that the Muslim community would be able to access because they were able to support them in making their products halal.
It's a relationship.
Yeah. It's not just a handout. Receive, mm-hmm. you get. It's more like how do you? We all start being connected to each other.
And how do we make it unique for our community? Mm-hmm. Let's make it work.
Yeah.
Magic.
Yeah.
This podcast was funded by the Public Health Association of BC. Brenda Barrett is my co-lead and the executive director of the Storytellers Society in Hazleton. Technical production by me, Christine Bruce. Music by Elijah Larson. Our food experts today were Diane Belisesh and Alana Pye in Prince Rupert and Peter LeBlanc in Vancouver. A big shout out to all our bridge builders who advocate so that everyone can eat local, nutritious food in BC. For more information on this or any other episode of Tempest in the Stockpot, visit storytellerssociety.org/tempest. Thank you for listening. I'm Christine Bruce, reminding you to stir that pot and to consider where you hold shame and what you celebrate. If your idea of opulence and prestige is exotic food at the grocery store, why not forage for local fruit the store doesn't sell, like black currants, thimbleberries, saskatoons, and soapberries, to lobby your local MLA for keeping the BC Association of Farmers Markets Coupons program, to write to Fisheries and Oceans Canada today because they're privately considering extreme policy changes that would restrict private salmon fishing, visit fishingrights.ca, and finally, to support the ongoing Salmon in Schools fundraiser in Prince Rupert by emailing food@equaltrust.ca.